Technorama episode 335 for February 29, 2012. The show with something extra.
This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
If I could save time in a bottle, where would be the best place to keep it?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama for February 29, 2012. This is a show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm Chuck Tomasi, and with me is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm sorry, excuse me, I was drinking beer.
What are you doing that for?
What am I doing that for? For a little while.
You're the beer guy, I'm the wine guy.
Oh, you're doing wine tonight. Oh, wait, it's because the doctor told you so, right?
Yeah, or something like that. We'll go with that excuse.
Wink, wink, nod, nod.
All right, I am very excited. We got a lot of stuff coming up in this episode. We have McFood you didn't McKnow about, Strange Animal and Strange Music come together, and Hollywood got it wrong again? All that and more coming up right after this.
It's Mick Unbelievable.
Welcome to Science Film number 12, the most rare case of Tourette's, Skiffy Tourette's. With science fiction weaving its way into popular culture, everyone everywhere is looking for a bright and shiny future. However, not everything is rosy. Along with all its benefits and positive messages, America's young boys and girls are succumbing to the dark chapter for our next generation. The phenomenon is known as STS, Skiffy Tourette Syndrome. Dr. Davenport, a speech and behavioral specialist from overseas, has made the discovery and has studied this for quite some time. Let's hear from the good doctor.
Skiffy Tourette syndrome is the result of persons consuming hours of science fiction material and focusing on the substantive words for cussing and swearing.
Or I'm fracking
juju-fly. The mind takes this input and causes the patient to uncontrollably and sometimes violently speak words at loud volumes to the point of yelling.
Fill the garb!
Often the patient cannot compose.
Frack!
Often the patient cannot gain composure of themselves until the seizure has passed.
Frack me!
Take, for example, this patient in this room. Lewis, how are you today?
Qing Wa Zhao Da Lu Mang.
That was translated as, you frog-humping bastard. Of course, this makes no sense.
Shut my...
So there you have it, Mrs. and Mr. America. Limit your science fiction. This sacrifice isn't just for yourself, it's for you and the children and our country.
This is Adam Savage from Mythbusters, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
Hey, welcome back. We want to give a shout out to the chat room. We do this every week on Google Plus Hangouts now. So if you want to join us Sunday at 9:30 Eastern time or whatever part of the world you are in, and you can do the math calculation from there, because in some cases it's Monday and maybe it's a holiday and you get lucky and you get to watch in the morning if you're in Australia.
Well, by the time they hear this, it could be any day.
That's right. But if you want to watch us live on Google Plus, join us there and we'll give you a shout out. Currently in the chat room, we have... Who's this? Getting beer. That's Andrew Peters. We have you and me, Dan Coyer. We have Ethan Green, who's just joined us. Mad Marv is out there. And, of course, Tim Elliott. All these people. We have up to 10 parking spots, and there's still a couple left if you want to join us. We'd love to see you there. go to Google Plus and connect with or circle
actually, if you go to chuckchat.com/technorama, there's a G Plus thing there.
There is. So mm-hmm. you can follow the podcast or you can follow one of us and it'll say, hey, we're in a hangout right now. So with any luck, we will get one of those on-air capabilities and we'll be able to broadcast this. But for now, you're all part of the gang. So welcome. Thanks. There's a chat room over there as well. So if you want to stick comments in there and whatnot and jibe us as we go, as we usually do. Turning to the birthday calendar, we have no birthdays this week.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
That's impossible.
Well, if it's your birthday and you didn't quite happen to make it on the birthday calendar yet, apparently. Happy birthday to you. But head over to chuckchat.com/wiki and get your name on the birthday calendar because we have this big gap between February 29th and March 7th, apparently. Now, I can think of two people I know that are not listeners.
Oh, wait. I know what it is.
What's that?
It's leap year.
So that screws everybody up? They have no birthday?
There's no birthdays on the 29th.
We'll get to that in a minute. There are a whole bunch of famous people with birthdays on the 29th. You know what people with birthdays on the 29th are called?
Leap babies?
Either leap babies or leaplings, which makes it sound like they're out of the Lord of the Rings world.
Or Yoda. You're under Yoda's tutelage.
Leaplings! Leaplings! Put down your lightsabers, you will.
Find Obi-Wan's lost planet, you will. Mm. All right.
Unfortunate you are to have birthday every 4 years.
Or fortunate hour. Hey.
Limited presents you will get.
What if Yoda was a leap baby? You know how old he'd be?
What was he, about 900? Maybe he was counting the leap years. Hey, you know the guy, I was watching some of the videos this week, and this almost made it into the stories, but it didn't. The guy who did Admiral Akbar's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it's a rap.
What's his name? The, in Jabba's place, he's got that Play-Doh hair that wraps around his neck.
Yeah.
Nebula, what was his name? Can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Maybe the chat room can help us out. Anyway, he did those two voices. He was the last trial candidate for Yoda's voice. Didn't know that until I watched this little interview.
He was the last candidate?
When they were doing tryouts, he was the last tryout for Yoda's
really?
Voice. Really? Yeah. And all he got was, it's a trap! And
hey, Jabba, no bother.
Anyway, we have voicemail.
Letters. Oh, we get letters. We get your letters every day.
In the mailbag, we have one from...
Turn that down just a titch.
We have a voicemail from our very own Bruce Barr once again. Apparently we made some more
Chuck,
mistakes.
Chuck, you got another phone call.
Who is it?
Bruce Barr?
OnStar?
Bruce Barr!
Juice Barr?
Bruce Barr!
Just answer the phone.
I don't know what you're trying to tell me. Have him leave a message.
Chuck and Craig, it is Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
Once again, 2 weeks in a row. Yay! Anyway, so I have two corrections, so very subtle corrections, right, in the ever, you know, present QC, which I provide for your podcast, and then a comment. So the two corrections are actually, I guess, three kind of, is I think I probably would have done reasonably well on the quiz you were talking about, but the Volga is indeed in Russia.
Told you.
Which does mean, at least at one point, Russia was included within Europe. Okay? It is only when the Eastern Bloc and the Iron Curtain came up post-World War II that we thought of Eastern Europe as being the communist countries under the influence of Russia and Western Europe. But before that time, most of those countries that were known as Eastern Europe in the Cold War were actually Central Europe. So technically speaking, Volga River, Russia, part of Europe. The other one was Sargasso Sea is the junkyard of the Pacific. Sargasso Sea is in the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
Which, of course, everybody would remember from watching Johnny Quest back in the 60s, where there were several things that involved the Sargasso Sea. At least that's where it first came into my mind to my consciousness. So, just a part of the endless bits of fluff and useless trivia that bounce around in my head. And, of course, listening to your show rattle some of it out, and I spew it out on the voicemail view. The other one was, I think, kind of ironic, and I was going to call you anyway, except...
Hang on. Before he goes on, I gotta stop right there, because
okay. The
Sargasso Sea always reminds me of a story my dad was telling me. We were out on our boat. We used to run scuba diving charters a long time ago. And the lake, we did this on Lake Superior. The lake was very calm that day.
Mm-hmm.
And the divers are underwater. And he's starting to tell me about how there's, you know, kind of seaweed and stuff slowly drifting by with the current. And he starts telling me about the Sargasso Sea. That's how I learned about it, was from my dad. Only while he was explaining it, he was telling about how there's all kinds of little creatures that live among the weeds and things. This is their habitat. Only he didn't use the word organisms. I don't know if he had a Freudian slip. You know where this is going? It's the first time I ever heard. I was about 16 at the time, and he said orgasms. And I laughed really hard. I mean, I tried not to laugh, but it's one of those. Did my dad just say what I think he said?
That's where they go. Oh, mystery solved.
And I think of the things I say in front of my kids. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Come up 30 years from now. All right, back to Bruce.
For the fact that it all ties together. So you mentioned that they were retiring the mainframe computers from NASA. And likewise, you also mentioned the early space program in 62, I think it was, which is exactly the time frame of the story, which I remember from Jerry Purnell, who was really, really pivotal in the early days of personal computing.
Dying in the background.
And was one of the first authors, let alone science fiction authors, who actually used the very, very, very early personal computers to write his novels. And he also wrote columns for Byte Magazine, the first real personal computer magazine. And Chaos Manor was his regular column because he called his house Chaos Manor. And in the new Byte, which is online, lo and behold, Jerry is back writing the Chaos Manor column.
Hooray!
Very interesting guy. And I remember, and I believe it was in the Chaos Manor column, but it may have been one of his other nonfiction kinds of writing that he did for Bain Books back in the 70s when I was reading all this stuff and the early 80s. He related a story back when he was, now I think he called it an operational engineer, or an operational analyst. Anyway, this was a job that he had with NASA, and this is the very early days of NASA. So it might have been 62, maybe even a little earlier than that. You know, NASA came into being once Sputnik went up there, and we were going to defeat the evil Ruskies in the race to space.
And we just
NASA
heard
got
Sputnik.
Created in 58. I actually looked that part up in the Wikipedia. The really early days, late 50s, early 60s, and he has this job. The actual job description for this sounded really cool, and I thought, yeah, I want to be one of those, and then he mentions later, it's basically what's turned into a systems engineer now. And I thought, oh, well, okay, that makes sense. That's why I think it's a cool job description. Anyway, so he's, like, it's his first week or two at NASA, and the guy he's working with says, okay, we got this, you know, the stuff that we need calculated, and we're going to go see the, we're going to go and we're going to use the computers. And Jerry was all excited because, you know, he'd never seen a real piece of big iron computing before, right? You know, this was his first chance to see a computer, these big, huge, very expensive machines, and it was NASA, and it was going to be great, you know. And so the guy walks him over to this other building that they are in.
Know where this is going.
They
yeah.
walk down this big, long hallway, and there, right next to the door, there's this sign, and it says, computers. And the guy opens the door, and there sits row after row of desks with people and adding machines And that was how they were doing some of the computing in the very, very early days of NASA. That story definitely stuck in my mind. So,
they're
anyway,
still there.
At least that calculation did not involve the big iron. It involved humans sitting there and crunching numbers. And so that was my NASA computer story. Always enjoying the show and always here to provide you slight nudges into the proper answers to the questions of life, computing, and everything. This is your fan, Bruce, calling you from Kansas City, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
No, well, like he makes doing life. This podcast easy. That was 10 minutes worth of...
So if you had rows and rows and desks of people, it gives a whole new meaning to the term personal computer, right? On this day in history for February 29, 2012, it was on this date in 1504 that Christopher Columbus uses his knowledge of a lunar eclipse that night to convince Native Americans to provide him with supplies. Give me supplies or I shall make the moon turn blood red.
See, look what I did. Look. Hey, did you know that there was actually a February 30th?
No.
Well, today in 1712, February 29th was followed by February 30th, which is chronological, of course, in Sweden, in a move to abolish the Swedish calendar for return to the old style. I'm not sure. I got to go read up on that one.
The old style sounds like a beer. Also today, 1916 in South Carolina, this is for you. The minimum working age for factory, mill, and mine workers is raised from 12 to 14.
Oh, well. Kids nowadays.
Don't know how good they got it.
I know it. Bill Keane's comic Family Circus makes its debut today in 1960.
An earthquake in Morocco kills over 3,000 people and nearly destroys Agadir in the southern part of the country that same day in 1960.
And also, on this date in 1972, Hank Aaron becomes the first baseball player in history of the Major League Baseball to sign a $200,000 contract.
Whoa!
That's out of here!
And 16 years ago today, Fawcett Flight 251 crashes into the Andes, killing 123 people. Happy birthday goes out of this date to Italian composer Gioachino Rossini. Oh, he did the Barber of Seville. Born on this date in 1792.
And also born today in 1840, submarine designer and inventor John Philip Holland.
The man for whom punch cards were named, American statistician Herman Hollerith, was born today in 1860.
And film director William A. Wellman, also born today in 1896.
As was the band leader Jimmy Dorsey in 1904.
And Vance Haines, an American archaeologist, turns 84 today.
The mathematician Gene Golub was born on this date in 1932.
And finally, American astronaut Jack Lossman celebrates his 76th birthday today.
And that's the way it was on this day in history for February 29th, 2012.
Nobodies.
Here's something in the news that I didn't know about. Apparently, a funny thing happens after you've been in space for a few days. The food you liked one day suddenly doesn't taste so good, and soon you're reaching for the hot sauce, even really? If you don't really like spicy foods. So, scientists wondered why this happened.
And look, well, by the picture, you just happen to have some Tabasco floating around in space.
Flying around in space, right.
Houston, could you pass the Tabasco?
10-4. Wait.
CB radio in space. Yeah. Well, the short answer is that people lose their sense of smell in space. You know, the sense of smell is tied to the sense of taste. So astronauts have reported that food doesn't taste right after a few days in the International Space Station. Coffee is bitter. Folks start craving sour and sweet foods, and everyone else starts reaching for the hot sauce. No one is really exactly sure why astronauts lose their sense of smell, but one theory suggests that once you start spending your time hanging around in zero G, all those fluids that used to get dragged down to your feet are now floating around everywhere, leaving you congested and diminished of your sense of smell. So,
why does everything taste like urine? Sorry, continue.
So a couple of weeks ago, CERN had reported that they discovered a particle that could go faster than the speed of light. But what they discovered after that was that a loose cable may have been the real reason for an apparent measurement of neutrinos exceeding the speed of light. So if you ever think you have found an amazing scientific discovery, check all the loose connections first and make sure that your, you know, cards in the slots are plugged in and the cables are all secure, and then check it again.
Hey, Captain Picard, we reached our destination. Oh wait, we had a loose cable. We only went 5 meters.
Engage. Get Wesley to put those isolinear chips back in.
Remember the Excelsior when it stopped? Kept thinking of the way it sounded.
He takes the spark plugs out.
But it was just the sound that it made. Like the engine cut off. The car. So who's in charge of QC here?
I don't know, but you know what I figured out tonight?
What's that?
That R2-D2 was probably the most vulgar character in Star Wars. They had to bleep out every one of his lines. Sad, I know. Yeah, I want to know who's on the quality control over at CERN. That's the news we have for today.
Hacks and strange stories.
All right, Geeks Are Sexy. They came up with an infographic of a bunch of McDonald's foods that I, frankly, have never heard about. Now, it's true that McDonald's is in every city. Well, and that the food actually tastes different depending on where you go, especially to different countries. There's different sauce to filling ratios.
Do you know what they call a quarter pounder in France?
A quarter pounder?
No. A Royale with cheese.
A Royale with cheese?
Do you know why?
Why?
Because they don't ain't got the metric system over there. No, wait. They have the metric. Wait, I messed it up. Sorry. No, I'm just kidding.
Never mind. No. You don't get a redo on that. McDonald's is one of the largest corporations in the world, a fast food giant that towers over the globe in the Golden Arches. That's why they can afford to put out tons of effort into research, market research, and why every Big Mac across the world is just slightly different to match the taste of the general public in that city. But McDonald's isn't the type to let their customers get bored with Big Macs. Nope. They go and do some experimentation. Not only are Big Macs slightly different across the world, even the menus change slightly. In fact, I remember seeing a McCroquette in Amsterdam, an emulation of the local fast food you can get from the vending machines there. Here is a cool infographic. It looks like a big exploded burger, but there's the McLobster, which is available in New England and Canada's lobster roll. The Ebi Filet, which is Japan's shrimp burger. You look down this thing, I'm not going to read every one of them, but they've got McSpaghetti in Indonesia and the Philippines. They've got McPizza, which was a failed late 1980s calzone style item similar to the apple pie. We have the...
I'm sorry, I'm laughing at these. The three little pigs are in the middle.
That's the cheese katsu, Asia's fried pork sandwich stuffed with cheese.
Isn't that called the McRib here in the States?
Yeah, something like that. They have the kiwi burger, New Zealand's beef patty with cooked beetroot, egg, tomato, lettuce, cheese, onion, and mustard on a sesame seed bun.
Okay.
All kinds of different things you can get. It makes me wonder what else they're up to.
McWiener.
The McHaggis. We can come up with all kinds of marketing ideas, but I don't think they're going to take any of them from us.
Yeah. I just want Mama Rick Rib back.
Every week I see one story that makes me go, that's Technorama, and this one is it. If I could have like a winning story of the week, this one, well, if you call any of our stories winning anything.
Winning.
Winning is right.
Badger,
this
badger,
is
badger,
a
badger,
taxidermied badger.
Badger.
Yeah, you remember the old badger song. Badger. A taxidermied badger with a theremin built in, you know. Right.
By the way, stop you right there for a second. I've been watching all the Futuramas I haven't watched in the sixth season.
Yes.
And I saw, well, there was a quick cutaway scene where it had Zoidberg playing the theremin. Woo! Do you remember that?
I'm going to have to go back and look.
Yeah, that's funny. Sorry.
Adding to the bizarre uses of taxidermied animals, David Cranmer made this deceased badger even creepier by turning it into a functioning and playable theremin. He calls it the Badgerman, but I call it the source of nightmares tonight. I have no idea where he sourced the animal, but the Badgerman's guts are now composed of electronics from a PAIA Theramax theremin kit with an 8mm removable antenna sticking out of the back of its neck. As odd as it looks, turning an unsettling stuffed badger into a theremin is rather apropos. The instrument is best known for providing haunting soundtrack to countless classic horror movies, though none of them send shivers down my spine quite like this badger creation does. Yes, because that's the first thing I'd think of when I have a taxidermy badger is, how can we make a theremin out of this?
Yeah. Or, hey, I got the spare theremin. I got the spare badger. Hey!
You know, there's two antennas, two poles that for a theremin. There's a horizontal and a vertical. The horizontal, the vertical is coming out of his neck. Guess where the horizontal is coming out of?
His rear.
That's right.
Looks like he's ready to be put on a spit.
Badger on a stick, my favorite. Send it to McDonald's. It might make a good food.
McBadger.
McBadgerman.
We don't need no stinking badges.
People taste it. They go, ooh.
Actually, what animal would you make a theremin out of? My first thought was a platypus.
I never had the thought. How could you say a first thought? That's not something that everybody thinks about every day. If I were to make a theremin out of an animal.
Right. These are the things that get me up at night.
Dude, you have too long of a commute if that's what you're thinking about.
What animal can I make a theremin out of?
I'd go back in time and remember when.
Remember when you had to burn wood or some fossil fuel to cook your food? Remember when you had one phone in your house and it was attached to the wall? Remember when computers filled a room the size of your garage? Technorama remembers.
We have a first story from the Remember When segment is rather sad. Pioneer pinball inventor, creator, Steve Kordek has passed away at 100 years old, which is a heck of a long time. But believe it or not, pinball, that most beloved of nerd pastimes, hasn't always looked the way it does with the flashing lights and bumpers. That particular design originated in 1948 with the Triple Action game, the work of Steve Kordek, who died this week at the age of 100. Kordek is credited with a number of innovations to the analog arcade games, including multi-ball mode and drop targets. Wow. All told, the Pioneer designed well over 100 different machines for Genco, Bally, and Williams. Hey, we'll be talking about Williams again in a bit. Some of the biggest names in the pinball pantheon. So, it was with heavy heart that we bid farewell to the man who provided us with hours of entertainment and cost us plenty of quarters. Before there were electronic video games, pinball was it, man.
Oh, yeah, they've been around, of course, for a long time. Even my son goes, oh, those are cool, you know. So,
they're still a lot of fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer some of the old classic ones that, not so many, digital flashy things in them. But almost more of a mechanical table.
Yep. Yeah, me too. One of my favorites, this is funny, and maybe you have one that comes to mind, but the first one that comes to mind is we had this arcade around from my house when we lived in Texas. Mm-hmm. And literally I could walk to it. It was near the convenience store and walk up there. And they got this one that really sticks out in my mind. I don't know if it's the first one I've ever seen or played, but it's called Gorgar. And it had a 7-word vocabulary. So it was the first one that really talked, and he would go, "My name is Gorgar," and it would then it would flash and stuff, and it looks like the devil on the glass. Well, it's kind of weird. He's got like
creepy.
A woman, it looks like a Franzetta kind of picture on the glass. It's kind of cool, but
remember the old games where they had like the analog numbers that rolled around? It looked like an old gas station or a gas pump.
Yeah.
And did you ever notice on the old ones, they only counted like by tens and they had maybe 5 digits? You got, 10,050 points. And as they became later generations, they added more digits. And when they went digital, you could play pinball and get like 250 million points. It's just they added more significant digits on there, but it's still the same old. You got 2,500, buddy.
And the last one kind of flips up and it's a little carry thing for the or power to two.
An exponent.
Yeah. Yeah, so those are awesome. I would love to have one here. Well, it's not an arcade. It's a place called Joe's Arcade. And right downtown.
It's called Joe's Arcade, but it's not an arcade?
No, what they do is they refurbish video games and they sell them.
Okay.
And you can go in and they encourage people to come in and play. I've talked about it on the show once before. They encourage people to come in and play and make sure the games are working before they actually sell them, which makes sense. So yeah, me and Harrison have gone in several times, and they had a couple of really old, like baseball type pinball machines. One where the ball would come out and little flippers, like you're trying to hit a home run or something. Some of those old ones, pretty cool. I may go back in there and take some more pictures, but Yeah. You know, I ought to even talk to the guys. I ought to interview them.
Hey, sounds like another road trip. What is that, two for you that are on your plate now?
That's right. I got two.
Okay. Make a list.
I do have a list.
Okay, now, a other story up in Remember When. During World War II, the American military began investigating methods to protect the civilian population from domestic saboteurs. One solution the military devised was this extremely eerie Mickey Mouse gas mask.
Nice. Now,
this is just, Disney would license anything, wouldn't they? These masks were designed to shield children from chemical warfare and calm them with the dead-eye visage of their favorite happy rodent. It would have been the precursor to an entire line of cartoon-themed gas masks, explained former Army instructor Major Robert D. Walk of the mask's production. On January 7th, 1942, 1 month after Pearl Harbor, T.W. Smith Jr., the owner of Sun Rubber Company, and his designer Dietrich Rempel, with Walt Disney's approval, gotta have that approval or Walt Disney will throw your butt in jail, introduced a protective mask for the children. This design was the Mickey Mouse gas mask for children. It was presented to Major General William N. Porter, chief of the Chemical Warfare Service. After approval from the CWS, Sun Rubber Products Company produced sample masks for review. Other comic book characters that were to follow? Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Sun Rubber Company produced approximately 1,000... Ooh, I wonder what these are worth today. That would be cool.
I don't know, but they're scary.
Well, every gas mask is scary.
Are you my mommy?
I was just going to say the same thing. Imagine if they use this one in Doctor Who. Are you my mommy? That is creepy. All right, we're going to take a real quick break, and we will be back with the Media Corner right after this.
Hey, this is Colin Ferguson from Sci-Fi's Eureka. I play Sheriff Jack Carter, and now back to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Hey, where can I find some good information about music and TV and videos and things?
Over here, in the Media Corner.
Okay, it turns out that Hollywood got it wrong again.
No.
It turns out you probably cannot survive an atomic blast inside a fridge, as we're all led to believe on Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Wait a minute.
As if there was anything to believe in that movie anyway.
It's all... At what part of it was truly believable?
Hitler burning books.
Okay, that's true, but...
Dang, one for me.
No, I mean, remember he met the one of the kings that was the king that was protecting the Grail.
Not king, knight.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Yes, he was protecting...
Wow, you're really good. Now, I won't admit that I saw Temple of Doom, so let's move on.
Well, good, because it's not the same movie.
Of everything that was wrong with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and there are lots, the atomic bomb scene draws the most ire and criticism from fans. And surprisingly, it turns out it's not even plausible. Whoa? Over on Overthinking It, Dr. David Schenner subjects the scene and the entire film to the scientific peer review. And after crunching the numbers on the energy and forces behind the atomic blast and the durability of a fridge, he concludes the filmmakers might not have done their homework.
Oh, come on.
You think? But the sketchy science aside, he also believes the scene hits a nerve with the fans over the nature of the character. The previous Indiana Jones films took place during times that are nostalgically considered more innocent, and Jones's ridiculous stunts come across as cartoonish pranks. But the threat of an atomic bomb and the memories of the Cold War resonate a little more deeply with the average moviegoer compared to, say, leaping out of an airplane with nothing on but an inflatable life raft.
Actually, wait a minute. The Mythbusters said that was plausible.
What, the life raft?
Yeah.
Yeah? I don't know. Who said the refrigerator thing was plausible?
Nobody. That's what I'm saying. It's just part of the movie, man. It's like, here you go.
Dude.
Wait a minute. Spider-Man, okay? When Spider-Man was swinging through Times Square, there were people, business owners, were upset because their signs were edited in the movie, so it didn't seem like a realistic representation of Times Square. Well, the guy that's swinging around on a web is not realistic either.
Right. How many Indiana Jones cosplays did we see at Dragon Con?
Oh,
lots.
Yeah. Countless. Okay.
I see one of them ought to put on a refrigerator.
Like a box. No, a refrigerator box. Frigidaire.
Guess which movie I'm from.
Yeah.
It'd have to be an old one.
The Phantom Menace.
All right, Craig, now, I gotta warn you. You said you're watching Star Trek Next Generation again?
Yeah, we've been watching it, yeah, on
Netflix.
Okay,
as you watch for Worf, because this next set of clips, it's 15 minutes. I can't believe they got 15 minutes of this stuff. Star Trek The Next Generation ran for 7 seasons, and in this clip that we have in the show notes, it's a little more culturally accepting future version of Star Trek. Even the violent Klingons were members of the Federation. Mm-hmm. Worf was the first Klingon to be a lead character in Star Trek franchise and has appeared in more episodes than any other Star Trek character. Wow. Even Jean-Luc and wow. Okay.
Oh, well, because he went on to Deep Space Nine and everything else.
Oh, sure. The only reason that we bring this up is because there's this 15-minute long video of scene in which Worf's impulsive suggestions get shot down. And, you know, he'll be standing there behind the you know, a tactical, and he'll say, you know, weapons are ready. And, you know, Picard will say something like, hold that.
No, I don't think so.
He just keeps throwing out these ideas, and it's always, no, Worf. I appreciate your suggestion. All this other stuff.
God, this is like work.
But as you're going through, just watch how many times he actually gets denied again and again and again.
I did watch this, and I was like, you know, he tries hard, but poor guy.
Well, that would really be demotivating if that happened at real life at work.
And he's a Klingon. I'm surprised he didn't rip off somebody's head after the third or fourth denial.
I watched about 3 or 4 minutes into it, and I said, seriously, there's 15 minutes of stuff here. You talk about ripping heads off. He almost ripped off a few heads, but he got denied of that, too.
Not only the denial, I was thinking the same thing. The denials, that's bad enough. But there's one scene where he's about to kiss Deanna Troi, and all of a sudden, Worf, report to the bridge, and he goes, ugh. I'm like, I'm surprised he didn't go nuts then. This is my chance. No.
We love you, Worf, even though everything you say is wrong. If you already know how much energy the Death Star would require to destroy the Earth, then you've probably seen the blueprints. But how much would it cost to build the Death Star, like in real life? The economics geeks over at Centives did some calculations, and based on the cost of the steel required to build a structure of that size, they figured it would cost 852 quadrillion, if my number of commas is correct here.
Good Lord.
That's like 1,000 trillions, or roughly 13,000 times the world's GDP. But then again, you can just take out a loan from the entire planet and then default on them in the most awesome way possible. So the Emperor had to do this twice to get two of these suckers built. And the second one was probably bigger, right? So it costs more.
Thank you for calling Quick Loans.
Yeah, I'm going to need a loan.
Okay, can I take your name?
Emperor.
Emperor.
Oh, it's the Emperor again.
Yeah. Oh, what's he want to
find?
Didn't
we give you a loan before? You never finished paying for the other one.
Arson. I mean, it blew up.
Rebel scum.
I'm sorry, sir. Rebel scum isn't covered under your contract.
So, well, if you need a loan for slightly more than $852 quadrillion. Want to build a Death Star? Then sell it on eBay. Oh, housing costs are down. It only sells for 800 trillion.
Let's go in half first, Chuck.
Halfsies. Let's start a Kickstarter project. I always wanted my own evil Death Star.
I wonder if you can put that number into Google and convert it to Quatloos.
Quatloos.
How's that for a crossover Star Trek Star Wars?
It's the grand showcase prize on The Price is Right.
Yeah.
Now, if that ever comes up on The Price is Right, you will know. I bid $1.
What the chuck?
What's up with that?
All right, I want to know who thought that putting the name iPhone on a gas stove was a good idea.
Anybody wants to make a quick buck?
Originally, if you use your iPhone to fry eggs, it's time to check when the warranty expires. Not so for the KIRF iPhones, which can't make calls or download apps, let alone use Siri, but you can fry your own bacon rather well. 680 one of these baffling branded gas stoves were seized by police in Wuhan, each bearing the legend Apple China Limited. It actually has an Apple logo and says iPhone on this little, looks like a camping stove. She's got a single knob and a single burner.
Even that little tag hanging off the knob says has apple on it.
It has a green apple, yeah. Apparently, the units did not come with the flameout protection and only ran iOS 4.1, haha, leading to the swoop. We should probably take this as solid confirmation that the iPhone 6's killer feature is going to involve making brunch on the go.
Hey, by the way, there is no mention that you need a bumper to make the antenna work.
Looks like they got that problem solved.
When I first saw this, before I looked at it closer and saw it as a stove, it looks like an old Apple computer.
Oh, I see.
Here's the caption for the picture. You press the Apple and it turns into a real iPhone.
Turn on the burner and you make free calls.
Free calls.
Who thought this was a good idea?
Again, somebody wants to make a quick buck.
I guess.
Buck. Buck.
Beady, 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 beady.
Well, we turned that one around, didn't we?
Okay, short lesson in the Geek Library. There are five or six of these little two-minute videos, some basic lessons on critical thinking and logic.
And oh, I need these.
Into the, yeah, and teach Harrison about these, too. It's about, you know, if you hear something and you know, make sure that what you hear isn't what you already believe based on your previous experience, and just some real interesting basic stuff. I'm not going to explain the whole series of them, but go check them out. They're interesting, especially if you're trying to teach your kids about critical thinking and logic. Get them thinking on their own rather than just believing everything they hear is the truth or everything they've seen in the past must be the same as what they see in the future. Got to get your brain juices going on this stuff,
wait,
folks.
It's not?
No. All is not as it seems. There is no spoon.
No, there's forks and knobs, too.
Just keep your hand out of the silverware drawer, buddy.
Oh, cool. I'm sorry.
What's that?
That is a side note. Are you familiar with Dirk Gently?
No.
He's the detective agent that believes that he was written by Douglas Adams in a couple of books.
Uh-huh.
And he believes that everything's interconnected. I think is actually a word he uses is interconnectedness. And I just see that on the sidebar on io9 that, well, they had a premiere episode, but it's been a while since they actually started airing episodes. And I think three of them are starting to air because the first one aired in December 2010, and they got three more either out or coming out. So I enjoyed it. It was a little different from the book, of course, and he's not anything like he's described as looking like. But no, it was really good, so I'm looking forward to it.
Late breaking news from the Technorama news desk.
Late breaking news.
I got to tell you, I wasn't a huge, huge, you know, like live in the arcade kind of video kid when I was a teenager, but I did play a fair amount. I had friends that did that, but
yeah, I'm one of them, Chuck.
I didn't say anything. I'm not making judgment calls here.
If there was a quarter within 100 yards of me, I had it and I put it in a machine somewhere.
You were the kind of kid that went bobbing for French fries for a quarter, right? Okay. Midway has come out with an iOS application for some of the most classic and favorite arcade games that I've played. Some of my favorites and some that I didn't get a chance to play that now I can. So on the iPhone for 99 cents or the iPad, there's a big screen version too. I'm going to pull it up here on camera too. So if you're watching on the live feed, you can see that. Okay, raise that up so you can see my screen. I feel so Leo Laporte doing this. So Midway has this. I'm playing Joust. Okay. Complete with the
what? Finish your sentences you can hear or the don't sound play. Effect.
Oh, I got killed. Let's go back to the arcade. They have a wonderful 3D rendering of this virtual arcade. And as you walk around...
Mm-hmm.
You can hear the music, right? You can hear the background. They'll tell you what games.
Arch Rivals.
So if you want to play it.
Root Beer Tapper. Rampage. Spy Hunter.
And.
Defender.
The sound effects alone are worth it on this thing. And you can play air hockey. You can go shoot some pool, although I don't like the pool all that well.
Oh, right? Yeah.
The sounds bring back so many memories.
Do you find, when you try to play a game like this, do you find the on-screen controls are a little off-putting as opposed to having a joystick in your hand? Or?
A little. This has... Okay. This has an on-screen joystick, which isn't too bad. I never really was that good at Defender, as you can see on the webcam. And plus, I'm trying to talk and play, which... I watched people that really... kick butt on this game.
There was actually sometimes
I would go around and shoot all the guys just for fun. Smart bomb.
You know, there were sometimes I'd be more content watching somebody play that was good than actually playing.
Oh yeah.
But now they can't shoot you for. There we go.
99 cents. How do you go wrong? That's four quarters in the old days, right? You can go downstairs.
I wish I had an arcade to go to like that, though. That looks cool.
There are add-on packs. The Redemption Center. Oh, and one of my favorites. You can use your tunes, like in the iPod music stuff, the music you load onto your iPad or your iPhone, and you can play that like it's a jukebox, or as I like to prefer, think of it wearing your old Walkman headset.
So Roll Ball!
There's Roll Ball.
What is that? Big, huge piece of ham.
I guess that's a break room. There's a ham on the table. And then some of these games, like Wizard of War, are 99 cents extra Wizard for this. These three that are on this. Did I just hear Q-Bert?
Gauntlet
2.
Total Carnage. Knuck. Basketball.
I played basketball. It's one of those ones where you... And of course, we played Joust. Whole lot of fun. 99 cents. Well worth it. Have you been watching the Clone Wars?
No, but what I've seen, I really like. It's a lot of fun.
The cartoon on Cartoon Network, right? The 3D, you're talking about 3D.
Yeah, the stories are fantastic.
The stories are fantastic. I like where they're going with this stuff.
And I just saw the trailer for the new one, the new episode, which comes out March 9th. I think it's either the finale of this season or something. Anyway, they're coming back on the 9th, and Darth Maul is coming back.
Really?
My thought was, how are they going to do that? Well, apparently, he didn't actually die. He's been incapacitated, you know.
Well, they've brought other characters back. Actually introduced them, kind of like prequel kind of thing. They had Captain Tarkin.
Well, we did see him in Revenge of the Sith at the very end.
Oh, Tarkin's standing there.
And he turns and walks off. He didn't.
If you're not watching the Clone Wars, I recommend it. It's pretty good. But I'm going to have to watch for Darth Maul.
Man, it's so good. I wish they would redo the Phantom Menace and everything in that style. It would be awesome.
With better actors?
Well, you know, what was that when they announced it, the 3D versions of the movies?
Well, you think about it. Some of these practically are movies because they have 3- and 4-part series that are 30 minutes long.
Clinton from Comedy Forecast, he said, no amount of 3D is going to make those characters pop. Emote or whatever.
Don't bring back Jar Jar, whatever you do.
You should just have him walk in the background. Just you didn't even speak.
Make him a video game where shoot at
you
him.
You know what? I never got to watch it, but I heard about the Phantom Edit. Have you heard about that?
Nope.
It's an edit of the Phantom Menace with less Jar Jar.
It always reminds me of that line from WKRP where Venus Flytrap signs on. He comes on right after Les Nessman.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, it's time for The Late Show with more Venus and less Nessman. And on that note, we're going to sign off ourselves. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate all your support. If you like the show, there are many ways to show your love. You can call the listener line at 206-222-2428 or go to the website, chuckchat.com/technorama, for all the different ways you can contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Either verbally, audibly, or writtenly, or whatever it. You send us a note. Let us know. Love to hear from you. Also want to give special thanks to Madmar for providing great blog content during the week. He had a couple out there that made me laugh last week. I mean, literally laugh out loud. And I'm working from home laughing out loud and feeling kind of embarrassed on some of those things. So go check out the website or subscribe to the RSS feed. That way you get his post and you get our podcast and everything's cool. Also want to thank everyone who sent us links and things during the week. Bruce Barr, who sent us a voicemail. Those of who joined us in the Hangout on Sunday night, thank you very much. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. Also affiliated with Farpoint Media and all the great podcasts over there. Check them out. We know you'll find something you enjoy. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama. And as always, a binary high five.
Oh, 101. Banta Pudu.